The Mysterious Circumstances podcast is hosted by Justin Rimmel. This is an American Crimecast production. Visit us at our new home at accproductions.org. Remember, everyone is innocent until proven guilty in a court of law.
Welcome to Mysterious Circumstances Podcast. This is a awesome bonus episode we got for you here today. I had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Edgerton probably a couple months ago now at a dinner for my cousin, and the best part about it, Les, as I walked in, he said, "Les, this is Justin. Justin, this is Les. You guys should talk." He's like, "You guys like each other." And we ended up spending a couple hours talking, and I just had to have you on the podcast. And the main reason being is because you have led a very, very interesting life, and you do very well by yourself now. And it's honestly, it's honestly impressive, and to be honest with you, man, quite an inspiration, man. You know what I mean? So,
I hope so.
Yeah. It is, man. It's actually very, very awesome. So, I guess we'll get started with, what do you do with yourself these days, Les, before we start getting into your past a little bit?
Okay, well, these days I write full-time, and that's 7 days a week. I get up about 5:30 and write till about 6:30 and have supper and go to bed, and that's 7 days a week.
That is awesome. And you've written... You've written what, 18 books now?
I've got 20 out.
You've got 20 out?
Yeah, there's three or four more due to come out this year yet. So
awesome. And you've recently, if I remember correctly, you recently sold your memoirs, is that correct?
No, actually I'd sold them several times before, and I keep pulling them back because I'm not the right publisher. And my agent's real close to sending it out now, and I know it would get bought because I've had so many offers before. Okay. I turned down several offers of $10,000, which isn't a lot, but it's decent as an advance. But yeah, it'll get out there. Then I'll have to move and change my name.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
Probably.
And let's see, you, what do you do with some of your other spare time? I know you run a blog as well, and you do some teaching classes online, and then you, I believe, speak at conferences as well?
Yeah, the blog is pretty intermittent. Whenever I feel like I've got something to say, I'll jump on there, but it's not a big deal for me. I write full-time, and I also have an online writing class for novelists that's been going on nonstop for about 6 years now. And we've had close to 36 people get their books published after going through the class.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if anybody else has got that kind of track record. I really don't. But they call it Les's Boot Camp for Writers, and I'm a bitch on there. It sucks, but then we also tell you how to make it better, so it doesn't suck.
Yeah, that's what it's all about, man, at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah.
That's very, very cool.
Yeah, I do go to quite a few conventions, writers' conventions and things like that, and they pay me, so that's nice. The best bit I ever had was a couple of years ago. I was a keynote speaker at the Oklahoma Writers Association, and they paid $4,000 expenses for that, so that's my tall cotton moment. I'm going to one, I think it's in August, in Green Bay, Wisconsin. We're going to be staying at a casino and hotel at the Green Bay Packers Zone. And in the Indians, and in that one, it's called the Police or the Writers Police Academy. It's a guy named Lee. I'm gonna have a mental part here now. Anyway, he's a very famous writer that hosts this police academy. Last year they had Lee Child, and so they have people like that appear. And I'm gonna get to appear this year and tell what they do at this convention, they all the attendees, they go through all the police academy stuff. In fact, they even put a body out in the woods, and they have to find him and figure out how he's killed. they're involved in shootouts and everything to do with police work, and I'm going to be the other side of the coin. I'm going to tell them how we evade all these police people.
That's useful knowledge on both behalves, I suppose. All right, man. Well, I guess let's dip into some a little bit of your early life, man. What was your home life like, and when did you actually start riding and eventually start getting into trouble? Or, you know, did you have a troubled childhood or anything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can't be a rider if you didn't. In fact, I was at a convention years ago, a writer's convention, and Mary Carr, who wrote The Liar's Club, a very famous book, and me were two of the speakers. And afterwards, they had a Q&A, and somebody asked us, they said, what does it take to be a writer? And she said, oh, that's easy. You just have to come from a dysfunctional family. And we're all nodding our heads wisely, yeah, yeah. And then somebody had a follow-up question, and they said, Mary, qualify a dysfunctional family? She said, oh, that's easy. Any family with more than two members.
Yeah. On a side note, man, I gotta say, your Facebook posts are probably the funniest shit I've ever read in a long time, man. You got, like, some of the greatest jokes on there ever.
Oh, well, yeah. I steal them all. But, I'm sorry, I'm trying to light a cigarette here.
No, you do your thing, man.
I was born in Texas and grew up between Texas and Indiana and some other places, but I had a real dysfunctional childhood. My mother was a religious cultist, basically. She was way out of her gourd. And my father was an atheist. It turns out it wasn't my real father. I found that out 4 years ago. All my life, he and my mother claimed he was my father, and then I found out that he wasn't. So that was a big upheaval in my life. Actually, it's kind of good to know, because he abused me quite a bit. Now I know why.
Yeah, that's probably good indication. Yeah, and you started writing from pretty early age on, didn't you?
Yeah, I was five.
Yeah.
I immediately after I read my first book, I thought, this is what I want to do, and I never wavered from that. And I thought at the time I could write a better book than the one I read, and I couldn't then, but I can now.
Nice. Yeah. What was it about writing that pulled you in personally? That just the escape of it, or...
Yeah, you pretty well nailed it, yeah. I really did have a fucked up childhood. My so-called father abused me in every way you can think of, probably a couple you won't think of offhand. My mother was absent to us. The only image I have of her is laying on her bed, reading her Bible, and the amount of yellow tissues all around her, where she was crying and weeping that she wasn't good enough for God and all this crap. And we were left on our own pretty much to raise ourselves. But I'll give you, for instance, when I was 12, we moved to Indiana. We were living in a farmhouse that we rented. And my mother was, I was cooking supper because she didn't do anything. I usually did the cooking. My sister did the laundry and the cleaning and all that stuff. And we helped raise our other siblings. But she came in. We had this old gas stove, and she came in while I was cooking something, turned the heat up on the stove, grabbed my arm, and put my hand in the flame until it was sizzling. And when I was yelling and crying and all this, she said, that's a small taste of what life's going to be like in hell if you don't get saved. So that was my childhood. That pretty well wraps it up.
Shit, man.
She had my dad build a doghouse. They put in the kitchen when I left home and joined the Navy. And whenever my sisters or brother got in trouble, they'd go in a doghouse. If they're really bad, they had to eat dry dog food for supper. But yeah, it was pretty bad.
So you mentioned the age of 12, and I believe that was probably right around the time you first started getting into a little bit of trouble, right?
About 10 or 11. A friend of mine, we're on a Sunday afternoon in Texas, which is a small town, Freeport, Texas, little bitty town in the Gulf. We were just cruising around town looking for trouble, something to get into, and we spotted a Lax sporting goods store, and went around back and crawled up a little shed next to it, and there was a window. We busted the window out and crawled inside, and I think I was 11. I think we were both 11. And crawled. We just had a field day. and I fished and hunted every day of my life when I lived in Texas. And we grabbed handfuls of fish hooks and lures and bait casting equipment and stuff. And then I saw a shelf with guns on it, and it was unlocked. And I reached in and pulled out a 38 police special and got a box of shells. And then we booked. And we, Richard and I, went down to the docks on the Brazos River, and there was a half-submerged barge that we used to play on, dive up in the water from and everything. And we took the gun down there, and we're going to shoot seagulls with it. And we just got in this barge, and here come six Mexican kids. And when I grew up, Mexicans, blacks, and whites did not mix. And I'll just tell you what, we called the black part of town Nigger Town. Everybody called it that.
Yeah, yeah.
And blacks and Mexicans had to live there, and they weren't allowed in our part of town after sundown unless they had a written excuse of a job or something. Anyway, the six Mexican came up, and the one guy says, "I'm going to fuck you up, white boy." He pulled out his little switchblade and started coming at these six guys, and I just took aim and fired a shot, and they all ran and dove off the end of the barge. And my friend Richard was laughing so hard, he said, "That guy thought you were actually trying to hit him." And I said, "I was." And it got sober pretty quick. It's just hard to hit anything with a pistol, especially when you're 11 years old.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to take his head off.
Yeah, I could imagine. I could imagine. Now, how did that, you know, did you end up getting caught or anything for that? Or
I got caught for very little I've done.
Fair enough.
When I was in the Navy 4 years, I was in the Bay of Pigs thing with Cuba, and I was in the start of the Vietnam War, and that was my Navy, 4 years in the Navy. But when I got out, I was just freaking bored. And so I eventually got sent up. I got caught twice, and I didn't get caught, but my rappies got caught, and they turned over on me.
Yeah.
That's how cops solve most of crimes. Somebody snitches.
Oh, yeah.
They get lucky and catch one, and he snitches and all the rest. And that's what happened both my times. But I forgot where I was going. I have Alzheimer's, so.
No, that's totally fine. Take your time.
let me think. Oh, anyway, when I finally got sentenced and sent to Pendleton, they got me for, I think it was 80 burglaries, 2 strong-arm robberies, a strong-arm robbery, and a possession with intent. And they did a plea bargain, reduced it all down to one count of second-degree burglary. I did a 2-5 on that. And when I was in Pendleton, President Johnson was president then, and he did this big study, appointed this Blue Ribbon Commission to do a study on prisons in the United States. And one day we were out in our cells over the other side in recreation watching one black and white TV, and Johnson broke into the thing with an announcement. And he says, "We have categorically studied all prisons in the United States," and he said, "The single worst prison by far is Pendleton." And we all got up and cheered like it was our Super Bowl team.
Yeah, I've actually had a couple of close friends that have been there, and that's, you know, not.
I had kind of an honor when I was in quarantine. I had John Dillinger's cell, and that's kind of a famous cell down there.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
It was kind of an honor to have his cell.
Yeah, he obviously, from those of you not from Indiana, John Dillinger is, you know, along with James Dean, is pretty much definition of Indiana, man.
Yeah, he was the first number one in the most wanted list.
Yeah. And yeah, a lot of people don't even know, hell, he was a hell of a good baseball player, too, but it didn't make him enough money.
Yeah. In fact, his birthplace is pretty close to where you are, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, actually. Yep.
Road.
Yep. Yeah, he, I'm currently working on a biography type podcast, hopefully be out sometime soon, but I actually chose John Dillinger as my first subject.
Really?
Just
cool.
Yeah, just because.
You know, it wasn't the lady in red.
That's what I've heard. I've
in orange.
In orange.
Yep.
And there's still a lot of speculation on whether or not he was even shot there in Chicago, but
probably was.
I'm pretty sure he was too. But you got to keep the legend alive, and a lot of people don't know that whole legend of John Dillinger is only like 13 months long. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't active very long. He was in prison for a long time. And yeah. Yeah, pretty yeah. much. So, when you got out after doing that 2-5, how was life after that? And did you have a hard time adjusting and stuff?
No, I wasn't in long enough. I did 2 years of my 2 to 5 and made parole. But when I got out, I landed in the best situation of my life. Nowadays, they don't believe in rehabilitation, but back then they still did. And I got into the barber school when I was in the joint, and that cost me 10 cartons of cigarettes, but it was the best look in the place. And what it did, it prepared you for a career or for a job, a good job. And they had waiting lines for us to get our barbering license in the joint, because a guy on the street went to barber school for like 9 months, and he cut one or two haircuts a day if he was lucky. Well, I went through it in 2 years, and I had 10 to 15 every day. We were so much better coming out of school with guys in the street, so there were lines waiting to hire us. We had our choice. And the first week of my job, that's in 68, I went home with $500. That was good money in those days.
Oh, yeah.
And never got below that. Went up to about $1,000 a week shortly after that. But that was in the late 60s, so rehabilitation did pay. The guys that went through barber school, about 85% of us stayed out. And I think the regular guys didn't have that schooling or trade behind them. I think their rate was about 25%. 75% went back. But so now I walked out to a great thing. It was the best two years of my life.
So tell us what it was like, daily life in prison. Do you have any interesting stories from being in Pendleton for that 2 years?
I have a lot of them. Mostly it's boring. You sit around it and, teach your trouser worm tricks and name all your 10 toes and shit like that. But you always have to be on, because you never know when somebody's going to come after you. They can be talking to you 1 minute, and next minute they go psycho on you. And it happens. So you got to be ready. I was lucky because I came from South Bend. I'd been living in South Bend since I got out of the Navy. And I knew a lot of the criminals. We all ran around together. And, excuse me, I got a fire one up here.
Nope, I got you too.
So South Bend was one of the larger towns in Indiana. A lot of criminals came from there. So when I hit Pendleton, I knew lots of people. And I was friends with a lot of people. And but if you're from a small town, you're really kind of screwed over, because you have no backup. You don't know anybody, as a rule. The guys from Indianapolis and Fort Wayne, South Bend, places like the Gary, places like that, usually have a lot of friends there, so you're pretty well watched after. And I was. I remember the first week in quarantine, I came back from lunch, and this black guy, and it's very segregated. There, blacks and whites never mixed. I don't know how it is now, but then, no. You would be caught dead with a black guy, vice versa, would be caught dead with a white guy, except the guys that try to make the punks. But this guy came up to me and challenged him. This black guy came up to me and challenged him what he was going to do. So we were going back in our cells after lunch, and Paul Dover is a good friend of mine. He ended up being a heavyweight boxing champ, apparently. He's truly a badass. And he says, "Who's the guy?" Point him out. So I said, "Okay," I pointed out. And Paul went over, we're in the third tier. He went over and grabbed the guy with two hands and flipped him over the rail and held him by his ankle by one hand. And the guy started copping deuces and crying and peeing, pisses running off his nose and shit. And Paul says, "You ever look at this guy cross-eyed, I'm dropping you next time." And he says, "If you see him coming to you across the yard, you better go to the other side, all that shit." And the guy was begging him to let him up. And I remember a guard walked around the corner, saw us up there, third tier. He just shook his head and walked back. But Paul eventually pulled him out, and I never had any more trouble with anybody.
Hell, that's all right, man. That's all right.
In a cop shop where all the criminals and the cops hung out in South Bend downtown one time, and a bunch of us were in there after we'd been pulling burglaries and armed robberies and whatever we were doing. And Paul was in a booth, two booths over from me. He was talking to this little Mexican chick he'd been dating. I guess she got pissed off at him, so she slapped him, and he grabbed her, and they went outside and back lot, so we all piled up and went behind him. But a gal reached in person, came out with a penknife and stuck it in Paul's neck, stuck it all the way to the hill. And Paul just laughed and pulled it out and threw it on the ground and poked her, hit her. That was the end of that. But that's the kind of guy he was. A little knife ain't gonna faze him.
Oh, shit. That's a pretty damn good story right there, man. What transpired after you, you went to barber school and started making a good living? Was it wife and kids, or did you start falling back into...
I did get married about a year after I got out, and I got two daughters by her. After I got out of the joint, then I started going to... started attending college at IU South Bend, IUSB, and eventually earned my degree there, graduated with honors of distinction. And I'm kind of proud of that because I went to school full-time, I worked full-time, and I had to support my wife and kid, and she didn't work. And I see these little lads about this little girl say, oh, I had to walk this distance between my classes. And you know somebody's paying her freight, and she's all stressed out about that. And I thought, fuck, you ain't got any problems, Cookie. Try working full-time and going to school full-time. Plus, I was student body president 1 year, and I had a part-time job where I wrote sports and stuff in Tribune and did some other stuff. I forget what, but I slept about 4 hours a night. But college is so easy. It was easier in high school, and high school is easy.
Yeah, people work pretty damn hard for that piece of paper, man. I tell you what.
I don't know why. You got a law degree, don't you?
Nope. What? Cousin does, though.
Oh, okay. Well, college graduates try to make out like it's a big deal. Trust me, it's not.
Yeah, I have no formal education after high school, and I actually make more than most college people with college degrees I know, man. And I'm like, I have no college debt, so it's kind of amusing.
I paid as I went, but I earned it all.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely,
plus,
man.
I was stealing and shit, too, so I was making good money there.
All right, so let's touch base on some of the other times you might have gotten into some trouble. I know you were incarcerated with at least one famous person that I can think of, I think, in Cochran, correct?
Oh, no, the Corcoran's is California joint. Oh, you're probably thinking about Charles Manson?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Charles Manson?
Yeah.
No, I'd gotten out and got a bachelor's degree and a MFA in writing, and a professor at the University of Toledo was writing a book called Children of Drug Users, and for some reason he picked me to be in the book, and he had Big Brother, and a Holy Company. He had Charlie Manson. And so he was out at Corcoran visiting Charlie Manson, and Russ Riesling is the guy who wrote the book. He had a copy of my first book, Monday's Meal. I had my picture in the back, and they're sitting in the visiting thing talking. And Charlie saw my picture in the book, and he picked it up and started reading. He says, man, this guy sounds like a real deal. He says to Russ, he says, you think he'd mind if I kept it? Meaning, give it to me. And Russ said, no, I'll get another one from him. So he read it. And he got a hold of Russell, and he says, this guy, I really like this guy. He's the real deal. He says, do you think he'd mind if I called him? And so Russ asked me, and I said, no. Well, when I was in the joint, you couldn't call out like they do today, and I didn't realize it was collect phone calls. But anyway, he ran up over $1,000 phone bill. My wife finally put the kibosh in that and said, put this crap. We can't afford this guy. But in the meantime, I was talking to Charlie, and he's a pure idiot. He's a punk.
Yeah.
He's in safekeeping. And he's in safekeeping to protect him because he would be out in the yard more 2 seconds if somebody had his number. And he's a little bitty shrimp. And he's a punk. So anyway, I talked to Charlie a while, and then my roommate wants to talk to you. And his roommate is a guy named Roger Smith, who billed himself as the world's most stabbed inmate. And it turns out he was. He'd been stabbed over 300 times and lived. But he'd been a hitman for every gang in the joint, and they finally put him in... safekeeping with Charlie to protect his ass, because he would have got killed if they ever let him on population again. So anyway, Roger starts talking to me on these freaking collect phone calls, and he wanted me to write his life story. And I kept putting him off, giving him one excuse after another, and finally he says, Les, he said, what's the real reason you don't want to write my story? And I said, Roger, you want the real reason? He said, yeah. And I said, well, it looks to me like you're kind of a serial killer. You keep doing the same thing over and over, stabbing people. He said, yeah. I said, well, I'm sorry. Serial killers to me are boring as hell. They keep doing the same thing over and over. And before that, he claimed he got religion, and he was saved and all this shit, except every other word out of his mouth was motherfucker this, motherfucker that. It didn't sound like anybody saved, I knew, but I know his brand of it's a jailhouse conversion. A lot of people get it. The instant they're out, it's gone. But he started cussing me, and he says, if I ever get out of here, you're the first guy I'm looking at, and I'm going to take you out. And I said, I laughed, and I says, dude, I said, you're in Corcoran behind 14-foot concrete walls, and I said, unless they had the biggest earthquake they've ever had in California, you're never getting out. And I said, if you did, I ain't worried about you, because you're a knife guy, and you're going to run into a gun when you visit me. So that was the end of my Charlie Manson, Roger Stone bit.
Oh man, oh that is great. That is great. So did
I don't know if you're in your other show, Unsolved Crimes. If you ever run into the Sylvia Likens story?
Oddly enough, somebody just sent me a YouTube video with some information on it, and I have actually literally just yesterday put that on my on my list of cases to do. Yeah.
It's one of the biggest crime cases in Indiana. It was a teenage boy, his sister, and a mother, and a daughter, all got sent up. The women got sent to women's prison, and the son got sent to Pendleton. He ended up being our receptionist at the barber school in the joint, and he's the prettiest guy I ever saw. I've never had any inclination to be gay or anything, but if I was, he'd have been the guy. He's the prettiest thing I've ever seen. And anyway, everybody thought, well, they're going to make a punk out of him right away. First day, some big black guy came up and hit on the quad, and he jumped up. He had to jump up because the guy was like 6'6", 6'7", and just cut his throat, and he bled out right there. But he's a little meat guy. He didn't weigh 120 pounds, but it's not your size in the joint. You beware of everybody. You never know.
Man.
But I knew him real well. I understand he's alive now, and I think he's sitting in Michigan City.
Oh, Michigan City.
When I was in, there was two joints. There was Pendleton and Michigan City, and the only difference was Pendleton was for inmates 35 and under. Michigan City was for 35 and over.
Okay.
And they have Sparky up there, the chair.
Yes.
That's the difference between them.
Yeah,
now,
they do.
All over the place. They got all different levels of shit. And
yeah.
All that, but... No, I kind of went to jail purposely. I don't mean I gave myself up or anything, but I knew I was going to get caught. And I've always been a writer, and I've always tried to look out for experiences, and I knew it was going to happen. I welcomed it. I got some good material while I was there.
There ain't nothing wrong with that, man. You got to have a muse of some sort, right?
Yeah, that's my muse. One of my wife says, you just married me for material, didn't you? And I said, yeah.
So let's talk about some of your books, man. You've written 20 books, you said. When was your first one published, and how did you feel about it? Was it like kind of like an accomplishment, like a feeling of accomplishment for that moment, or did you?
Yeah.
I'm sure like you writing from such an early age, I imagine, and correct me if I'm wrong, like, you probably always thought in the back of your mind it was always going to happen, just a matter of time. I mean, was it anything like that, or?
In a way, yeah. I knew I was a good writer. You either know you are or you don't.
Yeah.
Or you're not sure, and I've always been sure. My first book was called The Death of Tarpons, and like a lot of first books, it's a thinly veiled autobiography of my childhood, and it's centered on 1 year. And this might be kind of an interesting story. They sold out. It was published by the University of North Texas Press in hardcover. And it sold out a few years ago, and I got the rights back because they weren't going to republish it or anything. And a British publisher, Betimes Books, just came out with it in paperback. And Endeavor Press, which is Europe's largest ebook publisher, it is publishing in ebook format. It's doing great.
That's awesome.
And it's also, it came out in German. It's coming out in German. I've got two other books that are in German and some other languages, so I'm real proud of that. But that's, I don't know if you have many writers in your audience, Justin.
I do have some, yeah.
Yeah, okay. They might find this instructive. This was in the late 60s. I started sending things out, and it was all snail mail then. There was no internet or anything like that. And to send a publisher a manuscript, you had to send a manuscript, pay for the postage to get there, and you also had to include return postage to send it back. So it was pretty pricey. I remember it used to cost me $15, $20 every time I sent it out. So I was on my 86th publisher I'd sent it to, and the next one up is University of North Texas Press. And I went alphabetically, so you can see how long I've been doing this.
Yeah.
And I told myself if I got to 100, didn't get a take, and I was going to quit. Well, right after I sent the 86th place, I did a workshop in Indianapolis with Mary Evans, who's a former native of Indianapolis and now a high-powered literary agent. And she selected my manuscript for a workshop. So we were out having a break during the critique of my manuscript. And she says, Les, she says, you're having a hard time getting this published, aren't you? And I said, yeah. And she said, I can tell you exactly why. She said, my client... her client was Michael Chevron, who wrote The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, won a Pulitzer and all this shit. Mm-hmm. She said he had the very same problem with his. Editors see your book as a young adult, YA. And I said, it's not a YA. I said, any more than a separate piece is a YA. And she said, I know it and you know it, but editors often don't have the same kind of brain power we do. And she says, it's set around a 14-year-old boy, so they automatically put it in the YA category. And she said, Michael Chevron, her client, had done the same thing, so she advised you to rewrite it as a frame book. And I did that, exactly what she advised me to do, sent it out to the next press, and that was UNT, and they took it. What a frame book is, she said, they see it, you got a 14-year-old protagonist, so they automatically, in their minds, it's a young adult. She says, and besides, it's a teenage boy. And teenage boys are the single worst demographics in publishing, the single worst. They do not read. I know there are exceptions, but overall they don't read. They're also the single best demographic for movies, because those see the same movie 4 and 5 times. Nobody else does that.
Yeah.
But she said, and that's what happened. So to make it a frame story, I kept the book intact, and I added 2 chapters, beginning chapter, chapter 1, and the ending chapter. In chapter 1, I start out where he's an older man looking back at his childhood. And he comes back to childhood, and the rest is how I'd already written it. The last chapter I added was him coming back to adulthood and sold it right away. Well, that was lucky I ran into her, because it might still be sitting in my drawer. But the only reason that publisher picked it, the University of North Texas Press had never published any fiction. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And my manuscript was on the publisher's desk, the first one in a big pile she had for the day. And as soon as she saw it was fiction, she was just going to stick a rejection slip in it, send it back, go on with her date. Well, that particular morning, she told me all this later. She said her secretary came in with her coffee and spilled it and had to go back and make another pot. And in that time, she didn't have anything to do, so she picked up page 1 of my manuscript. In that moment, she couldn't put it down until she finished it. But if I hadn't gone to Mary Evans, and if I hadn't... It had landed on the desk as the very first manuscript. It never would have gotten published.
That's a crazy story.
There's luck involved a lot of times, but you got to be ready for luck when it comes.
Hell yeah. That's awesome. Of all your books that you've written, which one would be probably the one that you personally are most proud of? And why? Tell us a little bit about what it's about and why you're so proud of it.
Okay, there's 2 that are tied, Rapist and Fitch. And people do shy from those titles.
Yeah.
But the Bitch isn't what you think. It's not a pejorative term against women. Cons and district attorneys and all people in the criminal community refer to the 3 strikes and you're out, habitual criminal law, and you get life very close to it once you start out 3 times. We all refer to it as a bitch. And so it's about a guy that's been out twice, and his ex-cellmate gets out and begs him to do him the favor. He saved his life back in the joint, so he has to. And everything he does keeps backfiring. He ends up killing his wife, his unborn son, his partner, a couple other guys, and ends up back in the joint. And the rapist, so that's why it's called the bitch. Mm-hmm. And the rapist is... I wouldn't even going to put a rape scene in it, but my publisher did say, yeah, you got to put this rape scene. It's a... how do I explain this? It's a literary book. It's a philosophical book, and it's about a guy that back in toward the turn of the century, he's a recluse. He's got money. He's inherited money from his father. He went to school in Princeton, and he's educated and all that, but nobody likes him. They all think he's a nerd. He lives by himself and rides a bicycle around. And one day he's going to his home, and he goes to this woods, and he sees this girl. Everybody knows it's a town slut, and they're running a train on her, like four guys. And so he watches, gets a woody, gets off and everything. So the next day he's down, he likes to fish too. That's about all he does is fish and read. And he's down fishing, and the same girl comes by, and she starts teasing him, says she saw him there, and so she said she was going to give him some. Now, this guy's a virgin at this point. And then he says something about her pejorative, and she takes offense and starts to leave, and he grabs her and rapes her. She gets up after he's done and runs to the river, and a branch hits her, and she falls into the river and drowns. So they picked him up. He didn't try to get away or anything. And he's in prison, and it's mostly his thoughts while he's in prison. He says, I didn't murder her. I just didn't help her. She murdered herself, so... yeah, get me in a rape thing, but I'm not guilty of murder at all. And that was his argument. Yeah. But it goes through a whole lot of mental things and philosophical things. And it's a hard book to describe.
Yeah.
The Germans like it. That's my first book published in Germany, and they love it. I've had like 12 major newspapers rave over it so far. But they're a little, I don't know, I want to say smarter, but they're a little more in the deeper literature than the U.S. citizen is.
No, that's... I've come to find that out doing this podcast. A lot of the Europeans are a little bit more in-depth and intense with a lot of things as opposed to Americans.
They're more open to things. With this PC crap that's been going around for 10 years.
Oh, shit, yeah.
There's stuff up to everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could not agree with you more on that one.
I think it's the worst thing that's ever happened in this country. I really do. I think we're losing all our freedoms due to it.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more or less.
So, and my publisher wanted me to change the titles of both those, and I said, "Fuck no, I don't want those people reading my book anyway. That would be offended by that."
That's about how. That's exactly how I am too. It's my whole thing is if you don't like it, don't fucking listen to it.
Yeah, like twisted your arm or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's. I take time out of my day to put out content, and if, I always get a crack up when I get reviews, though, because I'll get a bad review, and it's like, you literally hated my one episode that you listened to bad enough to leave a review. And, like, I hate saying it less, but it's like, I get pleasure out of it knowing that I lived rent-free in their head long enough for them to leave a bad review, man.
That's funny. That's the that's my memoir.
Really?
Yeah. Don't rent space in my head. Son and I had that for our philosophy. We were watching a Candid Camera show years ago, and the thing was they took over this gift shop in a mall, and they put signs up all over the gift shop. No change given back today. So, and they had the hidden cameras and all that. Every time somebody buys something, go up and give them a $20 bill, they take it, or $5, whatever it was, would give them the change. And so everybody was pissed, and they were interviewing them and everything. Finally, this guy came in, he handed him like a $10 bill or $20 bill for $1.99 something. They didn't give me change back. And he says, can I have my change? And she pointed to the sign, it was right in front of me. He says, oh, okay. And he walked out. And he caught him at the door, and they said, sir, why didn't you get, all up in arms about this? And he said, I don't ever let anybody rent space in my head. I thought, that's my philosophy.
That's fucking awesome.
That goes through life in a good way.
It is, too, man. That is awesome. Too many people care about all the bullshit, and it's...
It sells.
Yeah, it does, man. It does. So you got any other interesting stories you want to share before we start getting into your future plans and all that good stuff?
Well, I don't know if I have any future plans. I'm going to get a freaking spinal operation, a whole bunch of... I probably won't be here. But anyway, yeah, I can tell you a good story about... I've written several of my books that have included Kat, a former girlfriend of mine in New Orleans. And her name was Kat Duflacer. She's Cajun Cunas. And I met her... I was in a bar one night that... actually, it's a bar that... I'm having trouble remembering people's name. Anyway, it's a real honky tonk, the Blood and Guts bar. And I'm sitting there one night. It's the kind of bar you always you always want to have your beer bottle in your hand, because if you don't, the roaches will carry it off. And this gal comes in, she was like fucking 11, if there's such thing as 11. I drop dead gorgeous. Coal black hair, purple eyes, or green eyes, I'm sorry, and Hooters out to here. And I sat next to her and said, can I buy you a drink? And we started talking. It ended up she invited me to her apartment that night, so we went and did our thing at her apartment. And next day she invited me to move in with her. Well, it was kind of a hoot, because she turns out, and I didn't know at the time, she was one of New Orleans' top call girls. And at the time, this is in early 70s, she was getting 100 to 200 for an hour. So I was big bucks in those days. And so I hooked up with Kat, and I moved in with her, because there's a trip that she picked me over all these other guys to, you know, be her bed partner or whatever. And anyway, she was nuts. Her mother sold her to Carlos. I can't think of Carlos's last name. He's head of the mafia there. It was till he died.
Oh, Traficante? Traficante?
No. It starts with an M. I'll think of it. Anyway, he bought her from her mom when she was 9. She said for $100. And then afterwards, she said, well, he bought her for a bag of weed, and that was worth about $100, except he'd get it wholesale. And so it wasn't worth anything to him. And she was with him. She was one of his little playmates until she was about 12. And she got way too old for his taste, so he kicked her out. He's done this to hundreds, if not thousands, of girls over the year. And she went down to French Quarter and prostituted and stole and robbed sailors and whatever she could do to survive. I met her when she was 25, and she graduated to call girl status. And most of them, he's done that too, die very quickly. Drug overdose, somebody kills them, shanks them, or whatever. And she survived. Really smart cookie, and I mean, drop dead gorgeous, movie star quality. But we had kind of a very rough relationship. I have a million stories about her, but this is one of the best. We'd broken up. She got me arrested. She shot at me, and neighbors called the cops and came up, and I told them it was my gun. It wasn't. It was her gun, and she shot. So they took me to jail, so we broke up. And a few months later, it was a Sunday, and I said, I'm not gonna lay any girls at all today. I just want to lay up by the pool and read the Times Picayune. So I did. I picked up six pack and put in my cooler, went out to the pool. I'm reading. I didn't get more than a page into the sports page when this girl I'd been seeing came up and says, hey, Les, you want to go see a movie? And I said, okay. So we went and saw, what the hell is that movie? It's the one that, anyway, I'll think of it. My memory's just going.
Yeah, and the mobster you were thinking of was Marcello, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. His nephew's a good friend of mine. He owns the bar he used to own now, and he has all the waste management businesses in town, which is a good mafia business.
It is, from what I've heard.
And yeah, but anyway, so I went with this girl. Oh God, what's the movie? Oh man, I'd have to get off and get into my file to. Anyway, hopefully I'll think of it. So we went and saw the movie, and I laughed all the way through. It was one of the funniest movies I ever saw. I came back and I tore one up, and then she went home. So I got back by the pool again. This other girl comes out I've been seeing. She says, "Hey, Les, you want to go to a movie?" I said, yeah, so we go to the same movie. It's what she wanted to see. And I kind of chuckled this time, but I wasn't laughing down until I cried. Went back to my place, tore up in it. This happened four times. five times. Anyway, so about midnight, the last one left, and I go up to go to sleep. Well, I'm the kind of person, if I get woke up while I'm sleeping, I can never get back to sleep after that.
Yeah.
And I just got to bed, just got to sleep, and the doorbell rings, and I go up, and it's Kat. And I says, Kat, we're over, honey. And she's, no, I got to talk to you. And she says, I'll tell you what, I'll come in, just lay down with you, and in the morning I'll talk to you while you're getting ready for work. And I says, I don't care, we're not screwing anything, Kat. So we go in bed, and I jump in bed, and she took the clothes off, she jumped in too, and she didn't try to put a move on me or anything. And about a half hour later, I'm just getting to sleep, and the doorbell rings again. And I go up, and it's Rochelle, this other girl I'd been seeing. And I said, I'm sorry, Rochelle, I got company. She said, okay, that's okay, I'll see you tomorrow. I just want to talk to you. So she moves, she goes away, and, excuse me.
Yep.
And Kat jumps up and runs the door and opens the door and looks out and comes back. And she says, "You're screwing it, bitch, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, no, I'm not. I was, but it wasn't any of her business." I said, "No, I'm not, but it ain't any of your business anyway." I said, "We're over, sir." And she said, "You're damn right." So she stormed around, got dressed, and slammed out of there. And I thought she was gone. So and then I thought, no, I better look. So I opened the door and looked, and I was on the second floor, the top floor, and a pool's in the center of the complex. And I looked down, and Rochelle's sitting in a lawn chair by the pool, and Kat's over just screaming at her. And I know Rochelle doesn't know who the hell this person is, what she's screaming at her for, or anything. So I come out, and I says, "Kat," I said, "get your ass out of there, and I ain't going to argue with them, calling the cops." And she says, "That's cool, I'm going." So she started, and people are creatures of habit. Kat always parked on the left side, and Michelle always parked on the right side when they came over. So they both got up. And I thought, I'll just explain tomorrow to Rochelle what was going on. She'll understand. She's a big girl. So I go back to bed, and then I thought, nah, I better double check. So I get up and look out the door again, and sure enough, Rochelle's going around the side to her car, and Kat's right in her butt. She did her mouth just go up a mile a minute. So I ran back, and I didn't have time to get, I'd sleep in the noon, so I grabbed a pair of skivvies, threw them on, and came back and ran around the walkway, and there's a little place where you can look out over the parking lot. So I ran around the walkway and got there, and I could see Kat and her. She's got her back up against this car, and she's just letting her have it. Her mouth's going like crazy. So I thought, oh, man, there's going to be some chitter. So I run downstairs, run around the corner. Just as I got around the corner, Kat took her arm up and hit her, and she hit her harder than I've ever seen a guy hit another guy. And she was going up to get her again. Well, what I didn't realize, neither did Rochelle at the time, she stabbed her. I thought she just hit her. So she's going up again, and I grabbed Kat's arm with one hand, and I grabbed Michelle with the other, and I threw them apart. Kat came up with the knife off her knees and tried to cut me, and I grabbed her hand and hit it on my knee, and she lost the knife. So my first thought is get the knife, because without that, she can't do anything. It's pitch dark out there, so I come around. I find the knife first. As soon as I find it, Kat sees I got it, she just let out a scream and ran to across the thing to where her car was, and I get this knife in my hand, and I'm trying to pull it, and it won't pull. It's bent in two places. It's a big-ass knife, not one of those little skinny things they show on TV. This is a serious knife. And I walked over to Rochelle, who was standing up against his car, and I said, "Oh, Rochelle, she hit you." And she had little tiny sprinkles of, looked like Tabasco sauce on her blouse. I said, "Oh, Rochelle, she must hit you in the nose. You got a nosebleed." She said, "No, I ducked. She hit me in the back." I said, "Well, turn around." She turned around, her entire blouse was bright red, and it was running like a stream down into her pants. And I said, "You've been stabbed." She says, "I have?" She didn't even know it. And I said, "Yeah." I said, "We better look at this. We better take you to the hospital." She said, "No, just go to the pool and you take a look at it." So I went over by the pool where it was lit, and looked, and all I could see was just like an inch and a quarter, inch and a half entry mark, and that's all. And the blood seemed to be stopping, and it would bubble a little bit. But I said, "No, I need to take you to the hospital." She said, "No, just take me up to your room, see if you can bandage it or something, I'll go home." I said, "Okay." So she walks upstairs to my apartment, get in. I found a towel, but didn't have any tape. So I ran down this corner apartment where an electrician and you live, and I said, "Hey, man, I need some tape, you guys." So he brought electrician's tape down. We wrapped this towel around her back. And she says, "Les, I think I'd better go to the doctor." She says, "I'm feeling kind of faint now." Well, as it turns out, she was lucky to be alive, much less walking up and downstairs. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Okay." She said, "But don't take my," she said, "take my car. I don't want to leave it here in case that bitch comes back." Well, it didn't dawn on me. Kat didn't know what she didn't know her. She didn't know what car. There was a reason for it. She had dope in her trunk. She just made a run to Houston. She had garbage bags full of dope in her trunk. She didn't want the cops to find that. But I didn't find that out until later. So I drive her over to this neighborhood little hospital, little clinic, and took her. And when I pulled up the emergency thing, Renicott came out, and I told him what happened. He ran, they got a nurse, put Rochelle in a wheelchair, and wheeled her inside. And I didn't see her till the next morning. Anyway, the cop came back, and he wanted to know what happened. I told him I had a knife, and I gave him the knife. And he said, "Okay." So I went in the waiting room. There wasn't anybody in there. It's like 2 or 3 in the morning at this time. I go in there and sit down by myself. And pretty soon, about 20 minutes later, here comes a real deal, a real cop. And he's got the knife and the Rent-A-Cop, and he asked me, how is she? And I said, I don't know, you have to check with the doctor. I said, my thought was, it hit a bone in her back, and that bent, that's what bent the knife, and you can bleed a lot from a little wound. And I said, I think she's going to be all right, but I don't know, you need to check with the doctor. Well, the guy never checked with the doctor. He just left, and I told him where she'd probably be, a place called The Godfather, which The Godfather actually owned. And he left, and about half an hour after he left, here comes this middle-aged woman and this guy. You remember Miami Vice?
Yeah.
The guy who was the lieutenant had all acne scars on his face. This guy was a dead ringer for him. This was before Miami Vice, but when I saw it, I thought, Jesus, that's him. Right up to me. I was the only one in the waiting room. She says, that's my daughter, and if she dies, you die, and this guy will do it. Well, as it turned out, this guy was a hitman for the mafia, and she was connected with the mafia, and so was Rochelle. I didn't know any of this. Oh. And I said, ma'am, I said, I saved your life. And she says, I've heard the story. I realize you didn't do it, but she said she wouldn't have been there except for you. And you, and she's my only daughter, so if she goes, you go. So I had to sit in the waiting room all night. And every time I go to the bathroom, I think, should I just book it to Canada or California or something, Mexico now? But I came back, and it, just as the sun was coming up in the morning, the doctor came out, and he got us all together, and he said, well, he says, we think she's going to make it. It was touch and go there for a while. He said, we couldn't get a clear picture of her lungs. He said, the knife went from here to here, and he from tip my middle finger to my wrist, which is about the length of the blade, it's about a 7-inch blade. He said, it went all the way in her, but he said, it barely missed her lungs, but we couldn't get a good picture until it cleared up, and it finally clotted and moved away, and I can't even measure the distance, but missed it. Otherwise, she would drown in her own blood. But and they had to give her 3 whole units of blood and all this shit. And he says, I think she's going to be all right now. So we get ready to go, and the woman, is her mother, says, you're still off the hook. She says, she dies, you die. So that was Pat and me. we got back together a couple times after that. But, yeah.
Oh, have you, and just... Just, I'm asking this question just for the sake of the listeners. Have you been to back to Louisiana or New Orleans since then?
Oh, yeah, sure. My wife, when I got married to my present wife, I said I can't live in Fort Wayne. I hate Fort Wayne.
Yeah, that's...
I'm getting used to it, but...
I've lived in worse cities, man, but I've definitely been around the New Orleans area, and it's so amazing.
Most exciting city in the world. I love it. The food's good. Yeah, I love everything about New Orleans. But we moved down here because I said I won't live in Fort Wayne. And she had a miscarriage and we ended up moving back, and I've been here ever since. So plans, man plans and God laughs.
Well, that's how Indiana does it, man. You leave and then it sucks you right back in somehow.
Yeah. And they send their women out after you.
I've lived in couple other states, including like Arizona and California, and somehow I always ended up back here, man.
Where'd you live in Arizona?
Phoenix.
Oh.
Phoenix.
I love Scottsdale.
Well, I wasn't rich enough to live in Scottsdale. So.
My best friend lives there. Yeah,
I lived in St. David for a little while, too, which is a really, really small town in the middle of the damn desert.
You live in Cave Creek, if you know where that is.
Yeah.
That's high dollar. His back view out his window is Black Mountain, mm-hmm. but his next door neighbor is Charles Barkley, and two doors down is the lady who wrote all the vampire books. I can't remember her name.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, she's a horrible writer, but
that was going to be my next question. Well, who are some of the more well-known people that you have met and that you like and dislike?
Oh, God, there's been a ton of... Well, I was in the hair business for a long time, and I worked for a number of top salons. So, I mean, I used to cut Ricky Nelson's hair. God, what's his name? He's dead now, too. All the ones I know are dead. Paul Newman cut his hair.
Now, I'm a huge fan. I'm a huge fan of the movie The Hustler because I'm a pool player.
That's my favorite movie.
Oh, God, dude. It's honestly my... I have 3 favorite movies, and it's The Hustler, because Paul Newman, I mean, for somebody who plays pool, let alone from a cinematical standpoint, it's such a fucking amazing movie, man. Yeah. And that, and definitely Rebel Without a Cause, and The Deer Hunter. The Deer Hunter is like...
I like both those.
Oh, man.
I see Once Were Warriors, and I bet you like that, too.
What was that?
Once Were Warriors. It's a New Zealand flick.
Yeah?
By Maoris. The city Maoris and the real ones, and it's really violent, but it's just a cool, cool story.
I'm going to have to check that out now.
I taught various universities from UCLA to Toledo to St. Francis, all over the place. And I usually get a film class, and I'll tell them, I'll ask them who the favorite actors are in today's generation. I'll say, like, Tom Cruise. And I said, Tom Cruise is not a freaking actor. I said, you want to see the difference between a good actor and a piss poor one? I said, go rent The Color of Money.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise is in.
Yep.
And then rent The Hustler, and then you tell me who can act and who can't. Because Paul Newman was the same age as Tom Cruise was, and he made The Color of Money.
Yeah.
He's a well-paid model. He's reading lines. That's all he is.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more, because, like...
Paul Newman was, like, 21, 22 when he did that. And, man, the freaking guy, I think he's the best actor I ever lived. You can have your Marlon Brando's novels. Paul Newman's my man.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The first time I saw that movie, I was just like, who? And, I mean, I was real young, and I was just... You're just it's so engrossed in the story.
Yeah.
And I think the part of it that attracted me to it, I suppose, is just the recklessness of him. You know, he was just so reckless. His character was so reckless in that movie that... And, you know, at the end, he has to walk away from the one thing that he loves.
Yeah.
You know, and then it was so great. The only good thing about The Color of Money was... Fast Eddie was back. You know what I mean? And
I was in the Navy when that movie, I was in San Salvador down by Cuba, when the movie came out, and I was the hustler at our base, so I picked up the nickname Fast Eddie, and that was my nickname all the rest of the way through the Navy.
Yep, that's the one thing all the non-pool players don't understand. That's one of them sports you cannot give yourself a nickname. You fucking... Somebody else has to give you one.
Yeah.
But speaking of which have you met anybody author wise or anything like that you just fucking despise, man? Just as a shitty person.
I don't feel that. I don't know who sees this or hears this. Yeah, there's several. There's a lot of phonies out there.
Yeah.
I won't tell you this guy's name because he thinks we're best friends and all this. I guess I'm his best friend, but he's not mine. But anyway, he got his rich daddy to wrangle a night in Sing Sing or one of the joints. And so he could write about the joint. Well, they protect his ass all the way in. Ain't nobody bad. He got kind of close to him. And now he thinks he knows what it's like to be inside. And he writes these god-awful books about, he's a bestseller, which makes me even more pissed.
Yeah.
Because it's all wrong. He's like those MSNBC pros, you know, in the joint.
Uh-huh.
They get all fucking wrong. All they show are the weightlifters and the psychos. And that's like 2% of the population. Weightlifters are totally harmless. They're so into their job lifting weights. They don't bother anybody. They're so steroided out, too. They're in a fog all the time. And the psychos, everybody knows them. You just avoid them. That's why people think it's in the joint, those two guys. They think everybody's getting raped and all this shit. It's just not like that.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty nice enlightenment right there, actually. Is there anybody that you were in the joint with that when they came out actually did some, you know, positive things with their life too, or did you have that certain group of friends that just kept going back, man?
Yeah, but I disassociate. That's one reason I stay out. In fact, Prolops, one of the conditions is that you don't associate with known criminals, and there's a good reason for that. Because if you do, you probably get right back in it. Peer pressure will take you there.
Yeah.
So, I didn't after I got out. I mean, I run into guys once in a while, but I didn't hang with them or anything. But the guys who went to bird school, almost all of them stayed out. Guys who are in other trades, most of them went back.
All right.
If they just do something, teach people an honest trade, they would see the rates go way down. Prisons today are really messed up. They really are. They get to do a lot more things than I could when I was in there. We don't have TVs in our cells. We couldn't call people. None of that shit they got today. and you couldn't cook in your cell. I mean, they have all kinds of free. TV would have got me through 10 years so much easier.
Yeah.
But it's still not easy to do time. I don't care what anybody says. They're never going to be country clubs.
Yeah. What was some of the little things that made your time go like a lot easier, and that, you know, would bring, you know, just that little bit of joy to your day, man?
Oh, when I see somebody get shanked or something, now he's making me feel good.
Because it wasn't you, right?
It's fun to talk about it. I was in Tahoe one day, my first year, and they feed you in shifts. There's about 2,500 inmates in Pendleton when I was there, and they feed you in shifts about 500. So there's four or five shifts going on, so you don't want to get everybody together all at once. So I was eating chow one night, and I looked up, and here comes this inmate cook, and he's got meat cleavers swinging back and forth the strike, and he gets to our table to a guy on the end of our table, and the guy saw him at the last minute, stood up, and the inmate just came up and buried the meat cleaver in the guy's stomach. As it turned out later, the guy was slow walking for a pack of cigarettes and hadn't paid him, so that's why he took him up. Well, the guy grabbed the meat cleaver, went out the door, and across the quads out there, across that is a hospital. So he walked all the way to the hospital, got almost all the way up the steps, and he fell down, and everything came falling out, and all his guts and everything. That was kind of cool.
Bet it was. I couldn't even imagine, man.
I was in 8 riots when I was there, not even counting the one I came in on when I first went down there.
Yeah. But pretty much free-for-all during the riots then?
Yeah, the reason they have riots is not for demands or anything, at least in those days, just so you can cook, so you can cook up some booze. Because the way you make booze, you sterilize your stool,
mm-hmm.
and you don't flush it the whole time. It takes about 3 days to make it. You get fruit, apricots or apples or whatever, and you put it in, and with yeast and all this shit. It takes about 3 days to become alcoholic. So if they didn't have a riot, they couldn't make fruit. They call it pruno now. I forget what we called it, but yeah, so we can make booze.
That's pretty interesting. Oh, man.
There were no gangs when I was in or any of that shit.
Really?
Yeah. It was like 10% blacks and 90% whites. I think I knew one Mexican. It was all traditional crimes in my day, back in the day.
Yeah,
robbery and murder and shit like that.
Yeah, none of that. Selling heroin to 13-year-old girls and shit.
Yeah. Yeah, now it's a bunch of suburban punks selling, don't supplement their allowances or whatever they do it for.
Yeah, I can definitely see that, that's for sure. So, what big plans do you got coming up? Or actually, before we get on that, who was a writer that really, really inspired you?
Oh, there's been a lot. Harry Cruz is one of the biggest. And nowadays it's Joe Lansdale. He's got a TV series based on his books on Sundance called Happ and Leonard. He's a real good friend of mine. He's one of the top writers in the country. And I got a huge charge because he told the world that I was his favorite crime writer. And that's high cotton because he's one of the best there is. But yeah, there's a lot of people that I think are great. Paul Brazel from England. I admire a lot of English writers and European writers. They're just more open.
Yeah.
Ray Banks, who's from Glasgow, he's a great writer. But no, I know a lot of. I do these workshops, and it's usually best-selling authors and me. I'm in with them when they do it. And Ken Bruin, who's a very famous writer from Ireland, world famous. He calls me the king of noir. So that's some people I really respect.
That's awesome. Did you fall into the crime writing aspect just because that's what you knew?
I've always written about crime. I like the dark side.
Yeah, don't we all?
Yeah.
That's very, yeah. Very cool.
I was writing crime stuff before I ever did anything.
Yeah.
But I wasn't very knowledgeable about it. I took all my info from TV and movies and crap and bad books. It drives me nuts when I see most of the guys I know that are writing crime They don't know the first thing about their idea of being a colonel is hanging out at a strip club or something. I don't know. Get thrown in a drunk tank for 2 days and that down they pour it all, and they don't know anything. But it drives me nuts.
Oh man, that's great. Before we start getting into your future plans and start plugging some of your websites and stuff like that, if there were any advice to give from somebody who has lived the life that you live and like been and seen some of the stuff that you've seen, and I mean, even if it's writing related, what kind of advice, you know, what kind of like say if you had 2 minutes in a room with some fucking idiot kid, you know, what would you tell that person?
First of all, I'd say don't write a novel. Go to Hollywood and write screenplays. That's where all the money is. It just is.
And in all honesty, I can definitely see that.
And it's so much easier. Yeah. I wrote the first screenplay knowing nothing about it except the basics. I wrote it in 2 days flat. And now anybody can write a bad screenplay in 2 days. This is very good. It was the semifinals in the Nichols Foundation Awards. And Nichols is the biggest, most prestigious screenwriter award out there. And it places the semifinals. That means I was within 100 of 4,500 people that sent them in. But it's a young man's game. If you're over 35, you're too old for Hollywood.
Yeah.
It's very ageist. But if you're a young guy, I would just say get your butt to Hollywood and start writing screenplays. Learn everything you can about it. If you're going to be a novelist, good luck. No money in it.
Yeah. Yeah. As we were talking, Kevin actually hooked me up with his press company, and I'm actually getting ready to submit a couple manuscripts.
Cool.
To be honest with you, I don't know the first thing about writing it, so I'm actually pulling in a co-author to help me. But I think, personally for me, I guess, it's not so much the money, but the story, you know? Because there's some stories that just have to be told that haven't been told.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
You know. 100%. Just self, you know, self-gratification, I guess you could say. Just knowing that you put it out there, but
there's some money, and then there's all the girls, all the women. I'm kidding. Have you ever seen fans and writers?
I saw some of Kevin's.
You don't get goofies like rock stars. They're much plainer, smarter.
Yeah, a bunch of librarians, right? Yeah. Oh, man, that's great. Let's tell everybody how they can get a hold of you and where they can find your books and all that good stuff.
I get just about all my books on Amazon. Just dial in my name, Les Edgerton.
Yep.
I have Blogspot. It's kind of long. It's www.lesedgertononwriting.blogspot.
Yeah.
/.
Okay. And I am definitely, what I'm going to do is I'm going to post all those links on all the social media that I use too when I publish this episode, which will probably be in about an hour. So,
I think under Les Edgerton, I also have a Twitter account called Hooked on the Wall.
Cool. Awesome. All right, Les. Well, I appreciate you taking the time out, man. And doing the interview and stuff, because like I said, man, when I was sitting there talking to you at dinner, I was just like, this guy is too much, man.
Thanks, Justin. You don't talk much about yourself in these, do you?
Not very often, man, to be honest with you. Not very often. But I don't know, nobody really cares enough to ask me about me. They're always talking about the...
back and interview you.
That would be pretty interesting, man. In all honesty, I've not had the life you had, but I've definitely had an interesting one, that is for sure. I've been a lot of places and met a lot of good people and, you know, met some of the best people I'll probably ever meet in my life. And, you know, I've been homeless.
I have too.
You know, done bad things to get by, to feed myself. And, you know, that's just how life rolls sometimes. And now I'm a dad and I do a podcast and... that's pretty much my life in a nutshell, man.
It's not great for myself, though.
That's been interesting, that's for sure. But yeah, people are more interested in all the dead people that I try to investigate is what it is. Some of the emails I get sent are pretty interesting, along with like random things on social media, but it's pretty cool.
I had one that you probably either done or you're aware of, the furniture magnate in New Orleans, and his girlfriend killed his wife. There was a big trial, and he had Effie Bailey and all this shit, and he got acquitted. But the deal was, the wife supposedly shot herself, but she was left-handed. The gun was in her right hand, and she held a pillow over her head when she shot herself, supposedly.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, it was a big-ass case. I had personal experience with that, because I got hired by bus at the Fairmont. Fairmont Hotel is one of the oldest hotels in the world. It's where they wrote the book Hotel. It was about the Fairmont. And then when they made the TV series and the movie, they switched to the San Francisco Fairmont, same family. But the original book was written about the New Orleans Fairmont. And I walked in my first day, and this gorgeous woman just comes sweeping into the shop. She's all Miss Melodrama and all this. And it turns out she was the girlfriend. I can't think of Aaron's last name. I have problems with names. She was his little babe. And he's a little typical Jewish guy, a little shrunk guy, older. And she's this gorgeous blonde. And she said, Les, I've read your resume, and I'm going to take the shop from Busta. And I'm going to need a manager, so I'd like to hire you. I didn't know anything about this, so I went in the back room and asked Busta. He said, yeah, she's trying. I brought her in for money because I ran into this huge debt doing coke. And she's bailed me out. Now she's trying to take over. She wanted all the styles from her taxes and all this shit. It's stupid. But I had to work here. I worked at 3 months, and I couldn't take it anymore. She's on one side pulling my coattail, come work for me. And I thought, if I turn her down, I might end up dead. I can't. If you look it up, Zarin something, they own a bunch of furniture stores in New Orleans. Yep. It was a big case, like the Candy Mosler case was.
Yeah.
Well, similar. I know you're familiar with that one.
Yeah, yeah. I actually just wrote that down. Now I'm going to check that out. That's for sure.
It's a Jewish name, something Witz, like Kirkwitz or something. That's not it, but it's something like that.
Okay.
It was a big case, and I was up front and close personal in that one.
Nice. All right, Les. Well, shit, man. You got any last rites you want to give out before we?
Just, I don't know. Keep your meatloaf and keep it cool too.
That's good advice right there, man.
Is our work here done?
Yes, sir. I hope I get to see you again here sometime soon, man. We'll have to meet up for dinner or lunch or something when you ain't busy.
I usually drink my dinners and lunches, so we can do that.
You know what? That sounds like a damn good plan right there.
Call anytime, Justin.
All right, man. I appreciate it.
See you
right
in church.
Yeah, see you later, man.
Give your offering. I need my dumps in general.
I'll talk to you later, man.
All right.